Have you ever looked at a massive, completely broken societal system? Maybe, I don't know, your local healthcare network or like the way housing is zoned in your city, or even just the corporate structure at your own job.
Oh, yeah. Constantly.
Right. And you think to yourself, you know, someone really needs to fix this, but then almost immediately you get this sinking feeling that whoever actually tries to quote unquote fix it might just, you know, create a whole new dystopia by accident.
Yeah, the cure being worse than the disease kind of fear.
Exactly. Because, I mean, usually when we talk about a like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of absolute precision. It feels like engineering.
Right, it's very mechanical.
Yeah, like you break your arm, you go get an x-ray, and that x-ray shows that jagged white line on the screen, and the doctor just points right at it and says, "There it is, that's the problem."
It's totally binary. I mean, either the bone is broken or the bone is not broken.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, the intervention is super obvious from there. You set the bone, you put a cast on it, it's clean, it's an isolated issue, and, well, the consequences of that fix are highly predictable.
Right. But then, and this is what we're getting into today for our deep dive, then you step into the world of civilizational
Which
systems.
is a whole different ballgame.
Oh, completely. We're talking about massive human coordination, things like trying to fix poverty or, you know, algorithmic bias or urban decay. And suddenly that pristine X-ray machine is just totally useless. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely hopelessly murky.
It really is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. I mean,
Yeah.
when you try to fix a societal injury, you aren't just putting a cast on an isolated bone.
Right.
You're intervening in this living, breathing, highly complex ecosystem. Every single action you take has these cascading, invisible, and frankly, often unintended consequences.
Which is terrifying when you're the one trying to make the rules. So, for you listening today, our mission for this deep dive is to crack open a brand new blueprint. It's a text that actually attempts to build a new kind of X-ray machine for those exact murky waters.
And it is a dense, highly anticipated document.
It really is. It's dated September 1st, 2026, and it's by Bechara Sahili, who is an independent scholar and a physician. The title is a bit of a mouthful, honestly. It's called The Transformational Laboratories Protocol Version 1.0.
It's an ambitious title for a very ambitious framework.
Extremely ambitious.
Yeah.
The goal here is basically asking how a civilization can theoretically learn to heal itself without accidentally reproducing the exact same domination or extraction or exclusion that caused the injury in the first place.
Yeah, and the subtitle of the document actually gives us a really critical clue about its core function.
Oh, right. What was the subtitle again?
It's From Civilizational Healing Theory to Bounded Life-Grounded Praxis.
Okay. Wow. Lots of big words there.
Right, it's very academic. But what this document actually is, at its core, is a pre-implementation constitutional and methodological framework.
Okay, I want to pump the brakes right there. A pre-implementation constitutional framework. I want to make sure we don't lose anyone listening right out of the gate with the academic terminology.
Totally fair.
What does that actually mean for you, the listener, in practical, everyday terms?
Well, think of it as the ultimate set of ground rules, rules that have to be legally and structurally agreed upon before anyone is even allowed to try and fix a community.
Like drawing the lines on the field before you play the game.
Exactly. This protocol represents that really scary jump from abstract theory to messy reality in what Sahili calls the civilizational healing project.
Right, because theory is safe, but reality is where people get hurt.
Precisely. It's an architectural blueprint for how we test solutions in the real world. It's designed to ensure that the very act of testing a solution doesn't, you know, crush the people it's actually supposed to help.
Which brings us to the very first conceptual hurdle of this deep dive. Before we can even talk about building one of these things, we have to define what the heck a transformational laboratory actually is.
Yes, because the word laboratory carries a lot of baggage.
So much baggage. I mean, we definitely aren't talking about sterile white rooms with beakers and safety goggles and clipboards here.
Far from it. If we look at the nested architecture of the broader civilizational healing project, which is the larger body of work this comes from, this protocol acts as the seventh logical layer.
Okay, so it's building on a lot of previous work.
Exactly. It builds on six prior canonical concepts. It starts all the way down at what the text calls the life ground.
The life ground, what exactly is that?
Those are just the basic, you know, biophysical and relational conditions required for any human flourishing, like
Right.
clean air, safety, basic trust.
Okay, got it. The absolute basics.
Right. And then it moves up through viability and research architecture and transformational capacities. But this seventh layer, the laboratory layer, is where all of that high-minded theory finally becomes vulnerable to real-world consequences.
Vulnerable to reality. I really love that phrasing. It means the theory can actually bleed now.
That's a great way to put it. It can bleed, it can fail. A transformational laboratory is formally defined in this text as a bounded, governed, real-world inquiry.
Bounded and governed, meaning it has strict limits.
Yes. It's a specific, localized setting, a place where affected communities, responsible institutions, practitioners, and researchers all come together.
To do what, exactly?
To jointly test whether a specific change in the rules actually reduces suffering and strengthens those life capacities we just talked about.
Okay, and here's where I really want to dive in, because the text goes out of its way to explicitly state what a transformational laboratory is not.
Yes, the exclusions.
Right, and honestly, the exclusions tell us way more than the definition itself does. Like, it says this is not a pilot program where success is predetermined.
Right, you're not just going through the motions to prove you were right all along.
Exactly. It's also not a communications campaign to convince people that a bad policy is actually a good policy.
No PR spin allowed.
None. And maybe most importantly for our modern context, it is definitely not an innovation sandbox where tech companies get to ignore ordinary laws just to, you know, move fast and break things.
Yeah, the exclusions are arguably the most radical part of the entire foundation. The protocol strictly forbids treating a population as experimental objects.
You aren't poking people with a stick to see what they do.
Exactly. The setting itself and the institutional relationships within it, that is what constitutes the laboratory. You aren't putting the people under a microscope at all.
What are you putting under the microscope, then?
You're putting the system's power dynamics, the institutional rules, and the resource flows under the microscope.
Oh, wow. That's a huge flip.
It is. Furthermore, it explicitly states it is not a therapy session. It's not some compulsory reconciliation program meant to fix allegedly defective or traumatized people.
I think that's a massive paradigm shift. I mean, okay, let's unpack this for a second. It sounds like we aren't putting society in a petri dish. Instead, we are fixing a plane while flying it.
I like that analogy.
But the passengers have a say in the tools we use. They actually get to read the altimeter to see if we're crashing. And crucially, they hold the parachutes.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize the power shift the text is aiming for. And the reason the passengers need to hold the parachute is because of a very specific phenomenon the protocol calls the competence problem.
Wait, okay, I got really stuck on this competence problem when I was reading the source material.
It's a tricky concept at first glance.
It really is. Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding the premise correctly, it suggests that everyone in a system can be doing their jobs perfectly, like absolutely flawlessly, but the system itself still fails.
Yes, that's the core of it.
But how? I mean, if everyone in a hospital is doing their job perfectly, the surgeon cuts right, the biller bills right, the janitor cleans right, how can the outcome be pathological? That just logically doesn't track for me. It sounds like a total contradiction.
It does sound like a contradiction, right up until you map the consequences across institutional boundaries.
Okay, walk me through that.
Let's trace a hypothetical patient through that exact hospital you just mentioned to see how the competence problem manifests. So a patient comes in with severe abdominal pain.
Okay.
The surgeon evaluates them and performs a flawless textbook appendectomy.
Right. So that's absolute competence.
Pure competence. Then hospital administrative policy kicks in. Now, this policy is competently designed to maximize bed availability for incoming trauma patients.
Which makes sense. You need beds.
Right. So the policy dictates a rapid discharge. The patient gets sent home to recover.
Okay. Still sounds like everyone is doing their job.
Exactly. Then the billing department perfectly executes their automated coding algorithm. They send a massive, highly complex bill to the patient's home.
The dreaded hospital bill.
Now here is where the boundaries cross. The patient, who is terrified by this impending financial ruin, decides they have to work a double shift at a physical labor job to pay for it.
Oh no. While they're recovering?
Yes. And while working, they pop a surgical stitch and develop a severe infection.
Wow.
But because of the pending bill they can't afford, they refuse to return to the hospital.
Because they're scared of more debt.
Exactly. So they stay home, they end up collapsing, and they are rushed to the ICU in septic shock.
Oh, wow. Okay. That paints a very dark, very clear picture.
Right. Look at what happened there. The surgeon, the hospital administrator, and the biller, every single one of them executed their highly specialized micro roles with 100% competence.
Nobody made a mistake.
None of them made a mistake according to their specific job description. Yet the macro system, the way those competent parts interacted without a shared feedback loop regarding the patient's holistic reality, it produced a catastrophic, life-threatening outcome for the patient.
So the whole is pathological despite perfectly competent parts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Therefore, a transformational lab doesn't just test individual actions. You aren't testing if the surgeon is good. You test how consequences, knowledge, and responsibilities cross those invisible institutional boundaries.
Okay, that makes it incredibly real for me. It does not about finding the quote-unquote bad apple in the system.
No, not at all.
It is about recognizing that the barrel itself is designed in a way that just crushes the apples at the bottom.
That's a perfect way to summarize it.
So how do we even start this? I mean, we don't just declare a lab open tomorrow and start changing hospital rules on a whim. There has to be some kind of gateway, right?
There is. Before any claim or any intervention can proceed, the protocol demands it passes three mandatory constitutional tests.
Three tests, okay.
And if it fails even one of these, the lab cannot legally or structurally exist. It's a hard stop.
All right, what's the first test?
First is the life capacity test. Fuss asks, does the proposed intervention actually protect, restore, or enlarge the biophysical and relational conditions required for flourishing?
So it can't just be like a software update for efficiency.
Exactly. It can't just save the hospital money. It has to demonstrably improve human life and flourishing.
Makes total sense. What's the second one?
The second is the non-displacement test. This asks, does an apparent win here just export a severe burden to another group, another ecosystem, or a future generation?
Oh, man. That second one is massive.
It's usually the one that trips up modern policy.
Because displacement is basically the bread and butter of traditional problem solving. We see this in city planning all the time.
Give me an example of how you see that playing out.
Well, okay, say a city wants to quote unquote solve traffic congestion in a really wealthy downtown area. So what do? They build a massive bypass highway. And suddenly the downtown looks great, the air is clearer, traffic flows perfectly.
Success, right.
Right, the mayor cuts a ribbon. But that bypass was bulldozed right through a low-income neighborhood a few miles away, destroying their air quality and literally dividing their community in half.
Exactly.
The city calls the traffic intervention a massive success on their spreadsheet. But this protocol says, absolutely not. You didn't solve the problem. You just moved the suffering to someone with less power to complain about it.
You nailed it. You merely exported the pathology. It fails the non-displacement test immediately.
Okay, I love that. And what's the third test?
The third constitutional test is corrigibility.
Corrigibility, meaning the ability to be corrected.
Yes. This asks, what specific evidence, dissent, or unintended consequence would actually alter the diagnosis or change the theory?
So you have to be willing to admit you're wrong.
More than just willing. If the intervention is designed in such a way that it physically or structurally can't learn from its own failures, or if the architects refuse to define what a failure would even look like beforehand, it fails the test.
So you can't just spin a failure as a surprise success later on.
Exactly. No moving the goalposts.
All right. So having this strict constitutional architecture, these three gates, that's great on paper.
It is very elegant on paper.
But as we all know, human beings are incredibly messy. I mean, we hold grudges, we miscommunicate, we have massive ego battles.
We certainly do.
To make a lab like this actually function in the real world with real angry people, the protocol relies on a specific environment. And honestly, reading this part, it challenges basically everything modern corporate culture has taught us about getting along.
It really does.
Right.
This takes us right into the core of the document, which introduces this concept of living coordination.
Living coordination.
Yes. The text describes this as the necessary effective relational substrate of civilizational healing.
Okay. Effective relational substrate. I'm definitely going to need you to translate that out of academia and into everyday English for us.
Fair enough. I could do that.
Yeah.
So effective refers to emotion, feeling, and psychological safety.
Okay.
Relational refers to how power and trust actually flow between people.
Got it.
And substrate is just the foundation that everything else grows in. Think of it like the soil in a garden.
So emotional and relational soil.
Exactly. Living coordination is the fertile relational soil that is absolutely required for a lab to work without hurting people. It is defined as the recurrent, embodied capacity of people to recognize each other's dignity, to coordinate action without forcing people to assimilate, and to collaboratively revise rules based on real-world consequences.
That sounds exhausting but beautiful.
It's highly active, and it operates across 8 specific dimensions.
Let's walk through a few of those dimensions, because they really paint a vivid picture of what this soil looks like in practice. For instance, the text mentions embodied and relational safety, meaning, as I read it, participants can actually dissent or even walk away from the table entirely without facing professional or social penalties.
Right. You can't be fired for disagreeing with the boss in this lab.
Which is huge. It also lists institutional trustworthiness, meaning when a powerful institution breaks a rule, it actually generates a material repair process rather than just, you know, issuing a slick PR apology on Twitter.
Yes, apologies aren't enough. Repair is required.
And then there's reciprocal care, where the actual burdens of participating, like having to take time off work to attend a 3-hour community meeting, are properly resourced and compensated.
Because if you don't pay people for their time, only the privileged can afford to participate in the lab.
Exactly.
So if you look closely at those dimensions, living coordination is fundamentally about power-aware participation. It's the capacity of a group to surface conflict truthfully, rather than just sweeping it under the rug to keep things moving.
And that leads to what I think is easily the most striking, counterintuitive part of this entire framework. It caters what living coordination explicitly rejects.
Yes, the rejections here are fascinating.
Because we are so deeply conditioned to think that, quote unquote, healing means everyone holding hands, singing kumbaya, and agreeing on everything.
That's a popular image, yeah.
When we think of fixing workplace culture, we think of corporate retreats, trust falls in the woods, and everyone being aggressively, almost terrifyingly polite to each other.
The mandated smiles.
Right. But this protocol explicitly outlaws what it calls coercive civility.
It does. The text makes these essential, really sharp distinctions. It states clearly that living coordination is not consensus.
Not consensus.
Right. You can have bounded, highly effective joint action amid principled, ongoing disagreement. You don't have to agree on everything to work together on one thing.
Right.
Furthermore, it is not harmony.
Say more about that, because that feels controversial.
The protocol argues that anger, grief, refusal, and highly visible conflict are actually seen as healthy indicators within this framework.
Wow.
Yeah. They don't mean the lab is failing. They indicate that suppressed reality pain that was previously hidden or ignored by the system is finally gaining standing in the room. It's finally being heard.
I love this concept so much. It makes me think of... let's use a family dinner analogy to really ground this for everyone.
I love a good family dinner analogy.
Okay, so say you have a deeply dysfunctional family.
Sure.
True relational health isn't everyone sitting around a beautifully set table, smiling through gritted teeth, ignoring the fact that the turkey is literally on fire and the roof is leaking, just to, quote unquote, keep the peace.
Right, because that's not real peace.
It's fake peace. It's a hostage situation. Mm-hmm. True health is the ability of that family to have a massive, loud, brutally truthful argument about the burning turkey and the leaking roof, while every single person knows, fundamentally, that their seat at that table is absolutely secure. They know they won't be disowned or kicked out of the house just for speaking up and pointing out the fire.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The smiling through gritted teeth scenario is exactly what the protocol warns against.
It's toxic.
It states that cohesion at any price is actually a pathological form of coordination. Cohesion that just stabilizes exploitation or relies on the silence of the most vulnerable people in the room to look pretty, that is the exact opposite of healing.
Man, that hits hard.
Social friendship and positive peace do not require you to be best friends with your oppressor. And they certainly don't require you to use a pleasant inside voice tone when describing your own oppression.
They require reciprocal standing and structural change.
Exactly. Which leads right into a very specific rule in the text, the anti-coercion readiness rule.
Okay, break that down for us.
This protocol strictly states that marginalized people cannot be deemed unready to participate in a lab just because they're angry, mistrustful, or outright refuse to reconcile with the institutions that harm them.
That fundamentally shifts how we deal with righteous anger in society.
It takes a strict anti-pathologization stance.
Anti-pathologization, meaning we don't treat their anger like a sickness.
Correct. It argues that structural injustice cannot be reframed as an individual's personal trauma or diagnosed as a defect in someone's communication style.
Right.
If a community participant is furiously yelling at a city planner during a lab session, you don't send the citizen to therapy to learn emotion regulation so they can be more polite at the next meeting.
Which is what we usually do.
Exactly. Instead, you identify the institutional, material, or power condition that is driving that justified anger and requires structural repair.
I really want you, the listener, to think about your own workplaces or maybe your local government meetings for a second. How often is professionalism or politeness used as a weapon to maintain an unjust status quo?
Well, it happens constantly.
Right. If someone raises a completely valid complaint about discrimination, but they do it with a raised voice or they look visibly upset, human resources often focuses entirely on their tone rather than the actual discrimination itself.
Tone policing.
Exactly. This protocol says that if a less powerful participant cannot contradict a powerful actor without losing their job or losing their funding or losing access to a vital service, then you do not have living coordination, period.
You just have well-dressed domination.
Wow. Well-dressed domination. That's a quote right there.
And importantly, the protocol demands that living coordination be measured as a profile, not an aggregate score.
Wait, what's the difference there?
It means you can't average out the eight dimensions to hide a fatal flaw.
Yeah.
You can't have a high score in interpersonal warmth and use it to offset a zero in safety from retaliation.
Ah, so you can't just buy a ping pong table for the break room to make up for the fact that people are terrified of the boss.
Exactly. If coercion or the threat of rights loss is present anywhere, the environment instantly fails the readiness condition. It doesn't matter how many trust falls you've done or how polite everyone is being.
Okay, so we have this beautiful, theoretically robust environment now. Marginalized groups can finally express righteous anger without being penalized. We have the relational soil tilled.
The soil is ready.
But let's be real here for a second. Good intentions and truthful conflict are completely useless if the person you're yelling at holds a billion-dollar purse string and can just walk away the second things get uncomfortable.
That is the perpetual danger of pilot programs, yes.
Right. So how does this framework actually leash financial and institutional power?
That is where the structural genius of the protocol really kicks in.
Okay, let's hear.
Before a transformational laboratory is even allowed to officially launch, it has to pass 10 absolute threshold judgments. These are known as the Q1 to Q10 hard gates.
10 hard gates.
Yes. They're documented in Appendix A. And just like the living coordination profile we just discussed, these aren't scores that can be averaged out. A fail on any single gate is a hard stop. The lab does not proceed.
Let's look at some of these gates, because reading through them, they are incredibly demanding. Like, Q2 demands a completely bounded setting.
Meaning, you have to know exactly where the experiment starts and stops, both geographically and socially.
Right. You can't just vaguely test something on the public. And T6 requires that protective financial margins be fully funded before any intervention begins.
We'll talk more about that one in a minute. It's crucial.
Definitely. But the one that really, truly stopped me in my tracks was Q3. Affected community authority.
Ah, Q3, yes. That is perhaps the most radical shift in governance proposed in the entire document.
It really feels like it.
It demands that the legitimate, well-resourced body representing the directly affected community must have actual binding authority over the lab.
Binding authority.
Yes. They get to frame the problem. They define what burdens are acceptable. They interpret the results.
Yeah.
And if necessary, they have the power to hit the emergency brake and pause the lab.
So they aren't just an advisory board that gets ignored.
No, they have real power. This introduces what the text calls the two-key entry rule.
The two-key rule. I really want to unpack this because it is vital to understanding the whole thing. It immediately reminded me of the protocol for launching a nuclear submarine missile.
That's a very apt mechanical comparison. Let's explore how that works in this context.
Right. So on a nuclear sub, the captain can't just get mad and press a button to launch a nuke all by himself.
Thankfully, no.
Right. The captain has a key, but the executive officer also has a key, and they are usually located on opposite sides of the room. Both keys have to be turned simultaneously to launch.
It requires joint action.
Exactly. So in this protocol, if a massive tech company wants to test a new AI-driven policing algorithm in a neighborhood, they can't just get a rubber stamp permission from the mayor and start. A material intervention requires authorization from two distinct sources. Key one comes from the legal or host institution, the group with the lawful authority and the money, like the city and the tech firm.
Okay.
But key two comes from a properly constituted body representing the people who will actually be policed by this algorithm.
The affected community.
Right. both keys must turn voluntarily and without any coercion for the lab to proceed. The captain, the mayor, or the tech CEO cannot force the executive officer of the community to turn their key.
Exactly. It's a perfect analogy. And the text actually anticipates the obvious vulnerability here.
Which is what? Bribery?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
You might ask, what stops that massive rich incumbent, the giant tech company or the billionaire funder, from simply buying off the community board? Or, alternatively, threatening to pull millions of dollars of unrelated city funding if the community doesn't turn their key?
Oh, right. We see that power dynamic all the time. A sponsor doesn't like the pushback, so they just override the community or financially starve them out until they give in.
Right. Financial leverage usually destroys theoretical boundaries. So how does the protocol prevent that?
Please tell me, because it seems impossible.
It mandates a power, incumbency, and non-domination audit. Detail in Appendix E.
An audit of power itself.
Yes. Before anything starts, independent auditors have to meticulously map the power dynamics between the two key holders.
What are they looking for?
They map agenda control, like who decides what is even allowed to be discussed at the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
They map resource dependence. Does the community rely on the sponsor for basic survival needs?
Which would make saying no incredibly dangerous.
Exactly. They map information asymmetry. Does the tech company have access to data the community doesn't even know exists? But most importantly, they map obstruction capacity.
Wait, how do you map obstruction capacity? What does that actually look like in practice?
It means identifying exactly how a powerful actor could legally, financially, or politically sabotage the lab if they don't get their way.
Oh, wow.
Right. Could they tie the community up in frivolous litigation for a decade? Could they launch a massive PR smear campaign to ruin the community leaders' reputations?
So they literally brainstorm the worst-case sabotage scenarios.
Yes. And once that capacity is mapped, the protocol places the sponsor behind a strict, legally binding, non-interference firewall.
A non-interference firewall. So it's not just a gentleman's agreement to, you know, play nice.
Not at all. It is built into the legal charter of the lab. The sponsor provides the resources, yes, but they legally waive the right to override a community refusal.
Wow.
They cannot override an independent safety pause. And they have zero veto power over the publication of adverse findings.
That is massive.
It is. If the lab proves the tech company's algorithm is racially biased and destructive, the company cannot use NDAs to bury the research. The community key cannot be bypassed or silenced.
That is an incredible relinquishing of control for a funder. I mean, it's hard to imagine modern corporations agreeing to that.
It requires a completely different kind of philanthropy and investment.
But let's take it a step further. What happens if things do go wrong, despite all these checks? Say both keys are turned, everyone agrees, the lab starts. But the intervention causes unexpected severe harm to a vulnerable group anyway.
This brings us back to Q6.
Right. Earlier you mentioned Q6 requires funded protective margins.
Yes. This is a cornerstone philosophy of the entire protocol. Protection precedes intervention.
Protection comes first.
Always. You are fundamentally forbidden from deferring protection until after harm occurs. You can't just say, oops, our algorithm accidentally evicted 50 families. We'll figure out how to compensate them next budget cycle.
Which is usually exactly what happens.
Right. This principle is operationalized through a mechanism called a remedy reserve.
Let's dig into the mechanics of this remedy reserve, because Appendix G details this extensively, and it's not just a vague corporate promise to make things right.
No, it is a highly specific, very aggressive financial instrument. Imagine an actuary calculating the absolute worst, reasonably foreseeable scenario of an intervention. And this includes looking at near misses from other cities and analogous historical cases. So if you are testing an autonomous delivery drone zone, what is the financial cost if the drones fail and completely destroy the livelihoods of all the local delivery drivers?
You calculate that total maximum cost.
Yes. The sponsor must take that exact maximum dollar amount and physically deposit it into a ring-fenced escrow account controlled by an independent, neutral trustee.
Before a single drone hits the sky.
Before a single drone is even unboxed. And the sizing of the reserve isn't based on what is, quote-unquote, most likely to happen. If a severe harm is even credible, you fund the reserve for it.
That is wildly strict.
And here is the true teeth of the rule. This reserve is completely protected from the sponsor's own insolvency.
Wait, meaning what?
If the tech company funding the drone experiment suddenly goes bankrupt and ceases to exist, the community's remedy reserve is untouchable by the company's creditors.
Oh, wow.
It remains fully funded and available for compensation, ecological restoration, or relational repair.
That is real material accountability. It shifts all the risk back onto the people with the actual power.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have the human relations locked down with living coordination. We have the power structures mapped and firewalled. The money is sitting securely in an escrow account.
We're ready to go, right?
Go almost. Because this protocol was published in September 2026, and there is a massive looming elephant in the room regarding what the text calls civilizational intelligence.
Yes, AI.
Right. How on earth does artificial intelligence fit into a system so intensely designed to protect human agency?
That exact tension is addressed in part four of the framework, which deals with the epistemic commons, data, and AI.
Okay.
And the golden rule established by the protocol here is absolute. Capability does not confer authority.
Let's break that down, because AI is so ubiquitous now, the protocol doesn't ban AI from these labs entirely, right?
Correct. It doesn't. AI is explicitly allowed and even encouraged to assist in the lab. It can be used for rapid data synthesis or translating complex legal documents into accessible language for the community. It's great for pattern detection across massive data sets, scenario modeling, finding anomalies. It is recognized as a powerful tool.
What?
But its structural role is strictly defined. It must remain embedded, augmentative, and absolutely non-sovereign.
Non-sovereign, meaning it doesn't rule.
Exactly.
It makes me think about how AI is constantly creeping into decision-making roles in our daily lives right now. Like, banks use it to approve mortgages. Courts use it to predict recidivism.
It's everywhere.
But this protocol seems to treat AI like the ultimate tireless super librarian and data cruncher, but it absolutely refuses to let the AI put on the judge's ropes.
That's it, exactly.
It can summarize the trial transcripts in 10 seconds, but it cannot bang the gavel.
That is a perfect encapsulation. What is so fascinating about this section is how meticulously the text separates epistemic quality from democratic legitimacy.
Okay, explain the difference between those two concepts for me, because they sound kind of similar.
They do, but they're fundamentally different. Think of epistemic quality as mathematical accuracy.
Okay.
An AI model might analyze traffic patterns and determine with 100% mathematical certainty that bulldozing a local park to build a roundabout will optimize traffic flow by exactly 40%.
Right, so the math is flawless.
That is epistemic quality. The AI is factually right about the math. However, that accuracy alone does not give the AI or its programmers the democratic legitimacy to impose that burden, the loss of a beloved community park on a neighborhood.
Right. Just because a machine is mathematically correct about inefficiency doesn't mean it gets to be in charge of human values.
Exactly. Democratic legitimacy requires human consent, value weighting, and the acceptance of trade-offs by the actual people who will suffer them. The machine doesn't suffer?
Right. The machine doesn't care if the park is gone.
Therefore, the text has a list of strict, uncrossable prohibitions for AI.
Let's hear them.
AI must not, under any circumstances, be used to determine human consent, community standing, or political legitimacy. It cannot adjudicate grievances or decide who is right in a conflict.
Wow, so no AI mediators.
No. And critically, it is strictly banned from covert surveillance, psychographic manipulation, and biometric emotion inference.
I really want to highlight that biometric emotion inference piece, because that is terrifyingly relevant today.
It really is.
It means you can't have an AI camera scanning people's faces and tracking their micro expressions during a heated community meeting and then feeding a dashboard that decides if a specific citizen is ready or cooperative or hostile.
Exactly. Which goes right back to the anti-pathologization rule we talked about earlier.
It connects perfectly, because if an AI is interpreting a citizen's facial expressions to judge their compliance, that is just a highly advanced technological tool of coercive civility.
Yes. The protocol recognizes that as a fundamental violation of human dignity. You aren't treating people as partners, you're treating them as data points to be managed.
And to ensure this human sovereignty is maintained at all times, I saw there is a hard design rule regarding AI outputs.
Yes. Every single AI output used in a lab must have an equivalent non-AI accessible alternative.
Meaning, you can't just throw up your hands and say, well, the black box algorithm said so, we don't know how it works, but we just have to follow it.
Exactly. There must always be meaningful human and institutional control. Reviewers must possess the underlying knowledge, the time, and the explicit structural authority to actually disagree with the machine and override its recommendations.
And without being penalized for, quote unquote, ignoring the data.
Precisely. Humans have the final say.
All right, so let's summarize where we are in this journey. We have the rules of engagement set.
Check.
The community is empowered and holding the second key.
Check.
The remedy money is ring-fenced in escrow. And the AI is firmly handcuffed to a desk in the library.
It is ready.
It is time to actually turn the key. How does a transformational laboratory practically operate over time? What is the day-to-day rhythm of this thing?
Well, the operational wrapper of the lab is meticulously organized into 7 distinct phases, which are governed by 7 corresponding gates, ranging from phase 0 to phase 6.
7 phases. Okay.
And it's crucial to understand that this isn't a simple linear pipeline where you just, you know, push a project through from start to finish. It is a recursive, highly responsive cycle.
Right. I'm looking at the flow here. Phase 0 is reconnaissance and baseline mapping.
Getting the lay of the land.
Right. And phase 1 is recognition and authorization. That's where the two keys turn.
Yes.
And then it moves through intervention all the way to phase 5, which is regeneration and consequence observation. And finally, phase 6, learning, closure, and reconfiguration.
While the phases provide a really good roadmap, the most critical operational features of this entire cycle are actually the mandatory pauses and the strict rules for responsible exit.
Mandatory pauses.
Yes. This is where the lab proves it is actually corrigible, that it can learn, and more importantly, that it can stop. Any participant with recognized standing in the lab can raise an alert at any time.
Wait, so anyone can just pull the fire alarm and stop a multi-million dollar intervention? Just like that.
If they meet the threshold of a credible report, yes.
Wow.
A credible report of serious harm, or if the protective margins are being depleted faster than expected, or if the sponsor is attempting to interfere behind the scenes, any of that instantly triggers a mandatory pause.
And what does that pause look like?
The sequence is explicitly legally mapped out. First, you protect the vulnerable. Stop whatever is causing the immediate harm. Then you suspend the intervention.
Yeah.
Then you notify all parties. You bring in independent review. You complete the necessary repair. And only then, after all that is done, can the lab jointly resume, modify the rules, or choose to terminate entirely.
That is so methodical. And what happens if the decision is to terminate?
This is a huge point.
Let's say the tech company realizes their algorithm is just causing massive harm. It's a huge PR nightmare, and they just want to cut their losses and run. Can a funder just cause a bunch of disruption, realize their pet theory didn't work, pack up their toys, and walk away?
Absolutely not. The protocol is crystal clear on this point. Sponsor exit is not closure.
I mean, that is a massive paradigm shift for corporate philanthropy and venture capital. Usually, they just disappear.
It fundamentally rewrites the liability of innovation. If a sponsor wishes to withdraw, they must fully fund the transition away from their intervention.
They pay to dismantle it.
Yes. They must fund the delayed harm follow-up to ensure no latent injuries pop up a year later. And they are responsible for any ecological or relational restoration required to return the community to a state of wholeness.
So they can't just leave a mess behind.
No. Withdrawal does not extinguish their liability or the community's claims on that remedy reserve we discussed earlier.
I noticed something else in this section that is deeply radical, especially regarding what happens if a lab actually succeeds.
The scaling issue.
Yes, because in the tech and business world, quote unquote, scaling is the ultimate unquestioned goal.
It's the only goal for most startups.
Right. You build a widget, it works in one city, so you scale it to 100 cities tomorrow to maximize impact and profit. But this protocol puts a massive, deliberate barrier in front of scaling a successful intervention.
It does.
Why on earth would this framework block the scaling of a proven good? That seems counterproductive.
Because the protocol recognizes a truth that Silicon Valley often ignores. A social intervention is not a chemical compound.
What do you mean by that?
It relies on specific human relationships, localized trust, and highly specific power dynamics. Scaling is not just mere enlargement. It fundamentally changes vendor dependencies, resource flows, and consequence pathways.
Give me an example of how scaling changes the nature of the intervention.
Okay. Let's say a local community in Boston creates a highly successful grassroots housing cooperative.
Okay, great local success.
It works beautifully because it relies on the deep historic trust between local neighbors and specific hyper-local legal protections in Boston.
Right.
Now, a massive private equity firm looks at the data and says, this is great. Let's scale this exact model to Mumbai. Oh, boy.
Right. They copy-paste the corporate structure, but obviously they replace the local trust with rigid algorithmic enforcement, and they extract a management fee. What was an instrument of empowerment in Boston instantly becomes a weapon of displacement and extraction in Mumbai, because the power dynamics scaled, but the relational substrate did not.
The trust didn't scale.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense. The context literally is the intervention. Mm. So how does the protocol handle a desire to expand if you can't just scale it?
Through what it calls the transfer and renewal bar, a successful lab must legally sunset after one bounded learning cycle. You literally have to shut it down and close the books.
You shut down a successful program.
Yes. If you want to expand it or transfer the lab to a new location, you don't just copy-paste the solution. You have to start entirely over at gate zero in the new context.
You need a brand new effectiveness map. You need fresh, uncoerced consent and new authorization from the new community. You have to prove from scratch that the essential functions of your intervention will actually work in a new environment with its own unique history, its own traumas, and its own power structures.
So if we can't just look at how fast a program scales to determine if it's quote-unquote good, what does this all mean for measuring success?
That's the billion-dollar question.
Because this entire recursive cycle relies heavily on knowing what is actually happening on the ground. But how does this protocol measure success when it explicitly outlaws traditional, simplified grading systems?
That complex reality check is covered in Part 6 of the framework, Evidence, Evaluation, and Falsification.
Okay, Part 6. Let's get into it.
Evaluation in a transformational lab doesn't happen on a linear scale. It happens across what the text calls an evidence cube.
An evidence cube?
Yes, defined by three distinct dimensions, time, scale, and perspective.
Okay, let's break down this evidence cube, starting with time.
Time means you don't just look at the end result of the intervention. You track the baseline before you start it, you track the immediate effects, and critically, you mandate observation for delayed, latent consequences years down the line.
So you can't declare victory on day one?
No. Next is scale. This means you don't just look at the macro-level economic data. You look at effects on the individual person, the neighborhood community, the institutional structure, and the broader biophysical ecosystem.
Got it. And the third dimension, perspective.
Perspective means you gather evidence not just from the scientists running the lab, but from the affecting people on the ground, independent observers, and hard biophysical data.
So you are triangulating truth from multiple completely distinct angles.
Exactly. And the most vital rule in this entire section, and maybe one of the most important in the whole document, is that the protocol expressly forbids the creation of a single, universal, civilizational healing score.
This is fascinating to me. Why ban a simple aggregate score? I mean, if I'm a policymaker or mayor funding this lab, I just want a single number, a dashboard dial, to tell me if things are better or worse. It's efficient.
It is highly efficient, yes.
Yeah.
But it is structurally deceptive.
How so?
Let's use an analogy to understand why an average score is so dangerous.
Okay, let's go back to our hospital example from earlier. Let's say you want to know if the hospital's climate control system is working.
Right.
And so you decide to just average out the temperature of the entire massive building. You take all the readings and divide. You might get a perfectly pleasant aggregate score of 70 degrees.
Which looks great on a dashboard.
Right. The dashboard turns green. The mayor is happy. Everything is perfect. But that single aggregate score hides a grim reality. It hides the fact that the basement where the janitorial staff works is freezing at 30 degrees, and the top floor ICU is literally on fire at 110 degrees.
Exactly.
An average score structurally, mathematically, hides the extreme suffering of the most vulnerable people in the system.
That is a phenomenal analogy, and it perfectly illustrates the mathematical danger of what the protocol calls aggregation error. Mm. A single score inevitably conceals critical thresholds, invisible trade-offs, and transferred burdens.
It just washes the pain away with math.
It does. The protocol firmly declares that marginal benefits given to a powerful majority cannot legally or morally compensate for serious, avoidable injury inflicted upon a vulnerable few.
Wow.
This is why all results in the lab must be rigorously disaggregated by mapped exposure, by vulnerability, and by power. You have to show the temperature of every single room.
I love that. And the protocol goes even further to actively resist the human tendency toward confirmation bias.
Yes, through a mechanism called pre-commitment.
Pre-commitment to the rules before the lab even starts.
Yes, pre-commitment is essential to prevent moving the goalposts when the data starts to look bad. Before launch, the lab must legally register its bounded claim, its baseline measurements, its specific indicators of success, and its adverse monitoring plan.
It's all locked in.
It's locked in. And critically, it demands explicit falsification conditions.
Meaning, as I understand it, you have to state, publicly and on the record, exactly what specific evidence would prove your brilliant intervention is entirely wrong.
Precisely. You have to define failure before you're allowed to try for success.
Which nobody likes doing.
No, it's very uncomfortable. What's fascinating here is the required use of an anomaly log.
An anomaly log, like tracking the weird stuff.
Exactly. Throughout the lab, negative cases, unexpected resistance from the community, and even positive deviants are meticulously tracked in this log. If the community violently protests your new housing algorithm, you don't just write that off as friction or pushback.
Right, you don't just say they're being difficult.
No, an anomaly challenges your core explanation. An adverse effect signals a possible deep injury. The protocol forces the designers to confront the very data that contradicts their pet theory.
Which brings us to the ultimate final test of the entire protocol, and really the core philosophy of the whole document.
Corrigibility test.
Right, because within this framework, a quote-unquote failed intervention, meaning the hypothesis was proven wrong and the intervention didn't work, is actually considered a highly legitimate, successful outcome of the laboratory process.
Yes, you learned something vital. The system worked.
However, the text clearly states a profound warning regarding this. It says, learning value does not convert a failed intervention into a successful one for the affected people.
That is such a crucial distinction.
Meaning, just because the tech company learned a super valuable lesson about algorithmic bias, that doesn't mean the people who were wrongly evicted should be grateful for being part of the experiment.
Exactly. The learning doesn't erase the harm. The people still suffered.
Right.
And ultimately, if the underlying theory itself cannot learn, pivot, and fundamentally change when reality and human pain contradict it, it violates its own foundational principles. If it can't learn, it fails.
So taking a massive step back to look at the whole picture we've painted today.
It's a big picture.
It really is. The Transformational Laboratories Protocol V1.0 by Bechara Saheli isn't just a dense, dry academic paper about research methodology.
Far from it.
It is a radically practical, deeply human defense mechanism against the unchecked hubris of power. It proves that a civilization can only truly learn to heal its deepest wounds if it legally protects its most vulnerable citizens.
If it strips the ego and the financial leverage out of institutional authority.
Yes. If it refuses to let mathematically perfect machines rule over messy human values, and maybe most importantly, if it faces the loud, complex reality of human conflict with absolute honesty, rather than forcing everyone into a quiet, coercive politeness.
If we connect all these intricate mechanics back to the bigger picture of our daily lives, this protocol really asks us to fundamentally reevaluate how we solve problems together. At every scale.
Right, not just at the civilizational level, but in our own lives.
Exactly. It demands that we stop treating affected people as passive objects to be managed or optimized by experts and start treating them as the most legitimate authorities in their own healing process.
I really want you, the listener, to think about the quote-unquote laboratories in your own life right now.
Like your workplace, your neighborhood city council, or even your family dynamics.
Right. When a deeply rooted problem arises in those spaces, are you relying on coercive civility and a single aggregate score of superficial happiness to just keep the peace?
Or is there enough living coordination and true structural safety that the least powerful person in the room can pull the emergency brake without any fear of retaliation?
Can your environment actually recognize its own injuries, complete genuine repair, and change its own rules without just creating a new center of domination?
That is the profound open question this protocol leaves us grappling with.
And it's a question we desperately need to answer if we want to survive the complexity of the next century. Thank you so much for joining us on this extensive deep dive into the Transformational Laboratories Protocol. We know your time is incredibly valuable, and we appreciate your curiosity and your willingness to wade into these murky diagnostic waters with us today.
Keep questioning the systems around you.
Absolutely. Keep looking for the power dynamics hiding behind the polite smiles, and keep seeking those vital, moments. Because fixing our civilization without accidentally building a brand new dystopia, well, that's going to take all of us looking closely and absolutely refusing to settle for a simple broken x-ray.